Hello, I'm Jonathan Mosen. Kelly Ford is a regular participant on many blindness-related email lists, and he's a keen advocate of web accessibility. On the Blindline show of Saturday the 18th of September, I spoke with Kelly about the work he does teaching people with disabilities to use assistive technology with their computers, and also about his advocacy on web issues. We began by talking about Kelly's first computer.
Back in 1985, I guess it was, when I was finishing up high school, I was a senior, my last semester, I took this class called Computer Math, and all of a sudden I needed something that would make the computer talk, and I lived in Wisconsin at the time, and there was a company called Raised Dot Computing near my city. I lived in a town called Oshkosh, or that's where I went to school. So I used an Apple IIe with Braille Edit.
That was a great piece of software for its time, wasn't it? All those dollar commands and things like that.
I remember the first paper I wrote on it. I thought it was pretty wild. You know, I could write on this thing and print it out, and my teachers could read it, and I could edit my writing and print it out without having to sit at a Braille writer and bang it out at the same time.
Yeah, we talk a lot about access, and of course we'll talk about access soon too, but it's interesting to think how for so many years blind people were typing documents on standard typewriters without even the ability to review what it was that they'd written.
I think about that fairly often because in my present work, I work at a community college and we do a lot of testing where the students have screen readers and things like that to write their papers, and I remember my freshman year of college sitting in a DSS office at Disabled Student Services, typing essay exams on a typewriter with no way to read them. And I look at where it's coming 15 years and I say, wow.
Yes, and many blind people have written entire postgraduate degree documents, like a thesis or for a PhD that way.
Oh, certainly, and I mean, I have a lot of respect for the people that have done that. I mean, I use an Opticon, you know, to read certain things, but I know people who have read entire books with that. And I can't say I've done that. I've read sections. And I think that accessibility and all that, I mean, I'm fairly outspoken on what I think is important in terms of accessibility, but I also know that we all make do with the tools we have.
The question of the Opticon has come up on the Blind Tech email list in the last couple of weeks, and you wrote a very interesting post about the Opticon and your use of it, and it's a technology that appears to be dying out, I guess because it's not currently being manufactured, although there are efforts to remedy that. Can you tell us a bit about the Opticon for those who haven't used one and how you find it helpful?
The Opticon itself, it really has two pieces. The first is a little camera. It's maybe the length of a cigarette lighter and a half. I'm not a smoker, so I'm just making a guess. And you run that over a printed page. It's connected via thin wire to another unit. Now, there's two models of the Opticon. I'll talk about the older one in terms of what it feels like. I think more people probably had that. It's maybe half the size of today's notebook computers, and you stick your hand inside of it, and you put your index finger on a little tray that they call an array, and then you can feel these pins vibrating, and that creates a raised image of whatever the camera is going over. It takes a little bit of time to learn. It took me maybe 3-4 months when I was 7 years old. I had to give up my noon recess. Wasn't too happy about it at the time. And because you have to learn how to distinguish, you know, the shapes of letters. I've said on the Blind Tech list and on other lists, it's one of the devices that I feel has made me as independent as I think I am because of some of what it allows me to do. Other people can do these same things in other ways, but I love being able to go home and just flip through the mail and see what's junk and what's not. Look for a particular page in a book when I'm trying to scan or when I'm having trouble with my scanning program, see what the print looks like. all kinds of things like that.
And yet, unless Blazey can rescue it, it appears
to... Oh, it'll be dead.
Yeah. It appears to be becoming a bit of a museum piece. Why do you think that is? What's happened to the Opticon and its usage, its take-up?
I don't think it caught on because like a lot of education and technology for people who are blind, a lot of schools, I think, in the K-12, are looking for the quick fix. You know, we're seeing the same talk about maybe that was going on in the 80s about the Opticon, in the 90s about Braille, where schools aren't teaching it because it takes time. And everyone wants something where you can turn it on and it's instant access and all the problems are solved without the learning curve. I don't think that's always possible. When I teach people, one of the points I make is that learning to use access technology is often like learning to walk with a cane or a guide dog. You've got to put in some time in practice, and you've got to do some very boring things before you can really fly, if you will, or get out there and get around. But schools aren't always willing to invest that time.
Do you think that there will come a time when OCR technology has been reduced in size so that you might have a small camera that will speak and scan and do all sorts of things like that, where the Opticon may in fact become truly redundant?
Maybe, although I think that in the science fiction world that would allow that to happen and really have it function at a level that works. By that time they might have also perfected some sort of artificial vision. And, you know, then all this access stuff will go away because we'll all get some kind of implant, if you will.
Would you welcome that?
If it worked and it wasn't going to zap my brain, sure. I mean, I ultimately think that's going to be the final solution that's going to solve our access problems, because we can take one kind of web page, and we can, you know, get what we're getting now, where the screen readers are getting pretty good at dealing with the HTML. We can take one kind of ATM where they're going to build in voice. We can take individual products and we can make them accessible, but it takes an awful lot of time to do that. You know, if you go to a different ATM that didn't have OLED built in, you're up a tree. With artificial vision, and whether that'll happen before I'm dead and buried, I don't know. But I think with artificial vision, what it means is you've built in a fix for anything that a person who's blind might encounter.
Although that would resolve a lot of access issues, I suppose there would be some who say that it would create a whole lot of sociological and psychological issues. In fact, I recall reading somewhere that although the number of people who say we're born blind and have gained sight is very small, that there is a high suicide rate among the group that actually has, because the world is in no way visually how they expected it to be.
Right, and I've read those same things, and I'm not a psychologist, so that's why I would never want to say let's put blind people up to some artificial vision device without really understanding what it would do. So I don't want people to think that I'm sitting here saying that some gadgetry is going to be our solution without questioning the impact of it. I just don't know, and maybe there'd be a way to address the things that have happened. The numbers that I've read are so small of people that have regained sight that I don't even know if it's a big enough sample.
Mm. Yeah, this is true. It's difficult to gain something that gives statistical credibility in this one.
You know, I mean, I know it's not going to happen today or tomorrow, so that's why I work on the areas that I do. But I just know that with anything, you know, when you try and build solutions into each product, it just takes a long time.
Mm.
And I don't think it gives the global answer.
So moving through the history of your computer evolution, I guess you would have been using an Echo speech synthesizer like all of us, would you, in the Apple days?
Oh, yeah. I used to say Burger as Berger.
You used to say a lot of interesting things. Yeah.
I started out with that Apple II and Braille at it, and I used that. Then when I went off to college, my next package was an IBM XT with two 360K floppy drives.
That was living.
Oh, it was. Yeah. And I had, I started out with Freedom One. I don't know if people remember that. A guy named Ned Johnson developed that.
That's right, and he moved on to a thing called ISIS after that.
Yeah. So I used that for a couple of years, and then I got myself a Toshiba 1100 Plus, and had Arctic Business Vision on that, and I used that up until I was done with college, and then I went off to my first job, and actually for a little while there, I actually used Telesensory's Vert Plus. That wasn't my choice, that's what they owned from some previous experimentation. Then in about 1989 or 90, I was actually using a Macintosh sometimes, and so on that I was using Outspoken, and then I started using JAWS. And I've tried all the other programs, and I use them, but, you know, I evolved from, like I say, from Braille Edit to Freedom One to Business Vision. There was a little bit of ISIS tossed in there, too. I actually used that when you could access the Prodigy system. Ned Johnson and a guy on Prodigy came up with a trick to, back in the early days, make Prodigy accessible with this jury-rigged thing. I don't know how many people actually even tried that.
I remember that. It had some very interesting, it was quite unorthodox, I guess, the ISIS screen reader, but it did have some very interesting features. I remember it had built-in support for handling the reading of text files in quite a comprehensive way. I wonder what happened to Ned Johnson.
I'm not sure. Actually, I live out in Portland, Oregon now, and I've lived here for about 5 years, and if memory serves, he used to live somewhere out here, but I've never heard his name of late, so I'm not really sure. If anybody knows, I'd sure like to know.
Yeah, yeah. What did you do at college? What did you major in?
I got a degree in journalism, and actually, all through college, I was more into journalism and worked at a couple of radio stations and a TV station and the campus newspapers and all of that than specifically disability stuff, which I do now.
So did you have ambitions to be involved in broadcast journalism?
Not necessarily broadcast as much as print. I was told early on by a broadcast person, in no uncertain terms, that my voice wasn't suitable for broadcasting on the air. It was rather a blunt meeting, and I prefer print journalism even today when I read as opposed to broadcast, only because I think it tends to give more in-depth coverage of material. But when you're in college, you'll take jobs and internships and everything else wherever you can get them. And so I did stints at a TV station writing TV news and a couple of radio stations.
And you would have been finding the technology, even at that sort of embryonic stage at college, reasonably helpful, I guess, to getting your work done.
Yes and no. I remember actually one of the radio stations I worked at, I was using nothing but a manual typewriter. Radio news stories tend to be pretty short, so it wasn't a big deal. But my job at that station was to write. I worked from about 6 till 11 at night, and I wrote a lot of the news copy that was read the next morning, you know, in the morning news. And in typical radio news story fashion, you have about 10 seconds of text, and then a sound clip, and then the rest of the text. And I always used to listen to the morning anchors read my stuff. And there was a news anchor back in Madison where I was doing all this named Judy Newman, who was really unflappable on the air. And I remember hearing her read one of my stories and coming out of the sound clip, and she just cracked up laughing. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And she called me. And sometimes in the morning radio news, you know, you don't even have time to read ahead of time what you're looking at. And it turns out that when I had you know, I always wrote the stories in my head and then played the sound clip and wrote the rest. I got my hands misplaced on the typewriter for the second half of the story. And so it was pure gibberish. And it just made her crack up.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, we certainly have come a long way, even in this short time. Amazing stuff.
But when I worked at the TV station, I had this guy, he was a techie, and he really loved my talking laptop. And he got me hooked up to the wire feeds back then for the Associated Press over that I could dial into their computer. And that was really the first time I had access to something like that. And I was just in awe of how much news I could read.
It's an empowering thing, isn't it? And it's not until a blind person actually gets to see for themselves, or even hear, I guess, through a radio reading service or whatever, just how much more depth there is in print media. You really just don't appreciate it.
It really is. I mean, it's radio. I love radio and all that, but I mean, when you can sit and read a story, and I've always been a words person, and I love language, and you just see some really good writing, you know, out on the wires and everywhere, and it just, it speaks to me. I can't really describe how, but I just love to read. And it's nice to be able to talk to other people about it and say, hey, did you see this? Or, you know, did you catch this? Or, we live in a world, we live in an information world, and, you know, and to some degree we're judged by how informed we are.
What happened after you left college? You were talking about your first job earlier. What did that involve?
And actually, I got my first job partly because of the Opticon. When I went to work, I had never heard of this place while I was in college, and some people might know it. It's a little research and development center housed at the University of Wisconsin called the Trace Research and Development Center. And they do a lot of kind of exploration of technology for folks with disabilities. I had actually given a presentation with a worker there. I didn't really know who she was or where she was working at the time. Right in maybe September of 1989, before I finished college. And then, like anybody, when you get done with school, I was looking for a job. And the Trace Center publishes this catalog of access technology. And they were looking for somebody to update that catalog. And I applied for the job and sat down and pulled out my Opticon and had to read these product sheets over the phone, like in a demo interview. So that was okay. And that job just evolved. I didn't find a job in journalism, got a lot of the typical rejection letters. And I started to like some of what the Trace Center was doing and getting exposed to all this technology. You know, I was young, 22, and all of a sudden getting in on all the cutting-edge computer stuff and finding out things, and so it was kind of neat. So I worked there for about 5 years doing different tasks. I did some technical support for some software they released, did some training, went out to the conventions, you know, the Closing the Gap, the CSUN, and did the convention dog and pony show for the stuff that the Trace Center put out. And it was kind of fun. In about 1990 or 91, I got to help staff a booth at Comdex that Microsoft and Apple put on for disabilities. I mean, so here I am, you know, 22, 23, staffing an exhibit booth at the major trade show in the mainstream computer field. So I thought that was pretty cool.
It's funny how these things pan out, isn't it? Because obviously you weren't really looking for a career dealing with access technology. It was more, what was supposed to be more of a tool to help you achieve your other ambitions.
Clearly, I mean, when I was in college, you know, all I really used the computer and access technology for was, does it meet my needs? And as I worked at the Trace Center and talked to people, I thought, well, you know, I'm not bragging, but I thought I'm kind of good at teaching people this stuff and finding out what's out there and, you know, helping people find what's out there. And it just amazes me, even today, more so back then, how many people still don't know what's out there. And I kind of fell into it, and I've been doing it for 10 years now, so I must like it.
That's something that's come up a couple of times in the Blindline interviews that I've done in recent months, that people are being guided towards certain types of access technology, not so much because it's the right answer for them, but because it's what particular instructors or assessors are comfortable recommending. And that seems to be a real issue right across the world.
I think it is, and I make no secret on the internet forums and things like that of what my personal preferences are. There's a reason why I clearly state that, and it's because if in the people I work with or things like that, if my biases towards my tools of choice are showing in the things I say about other tools, you know, I mean, I clearly make no bones that I use JAWS for Windows, and if my biases against other programs in my personal choice are showing when I comment about them, I hope people will take me to task. You know, I use OpenBook for my scanning system, and But I show other people all the options that they have, and I try to be objective. And I can say part of the reason I'm very open and public about my personal choices is for the reason that I said. We're all creatures of habit, though, and we probably do unintentionally or intentionally guide people a little bit. My big philosophy is try it on what you're going to use, though, because I don't care what anybody tells you that something will work for sure. I've been around 15 years, and I mean, I actually, my first, that IBM XT I talked to you about, it sat in a box sat on my desk for 3 months because I couldn't get it working, and I was so green to all this stuff. I didn't know what to do. I mean, it took me 3 months to figure it out, and the guy I bought it from said, oh, no problem, you just hook it up and it will work. You know, so I've been there with my stuff not working. So I really try to tell people, especially now, get a demo, try it.
Yes, and the wonderful thing about the access technology industry these days is that just about everyone has one now.
I think that, you know, they've clearly learned that that is necessary. And I think it's easier to do that now. You know, one of the things that's really changed in the last couple of years is software speech. So you don't have to worry about getting some, for the demos especially, making sure a guy's got the right synthesizer or all of that. You can get it talking on the person's computer. And if they want to change to a hardware synthesizer, they can. So I think that the software speech and just the more computing power and the recognition that demos work has helped us.
I suppose one of the problems with demoing Windows screen readers, and it probably doesn't apply as much when you're looking at, say, standalone blindness-specific OCR products, but one of the problems is that you're grappling with two issues. You're grappling with the screen reader interface, and if you've never used the Windows operating system before, you're trying to come to grips with those concepts at the same time.
I think you are, and I wish, you know, I think that on the internet especially, we see the cream of the crop in terms of people that are skilled with their screen reader. Because I'm telling you that of the people I know of who are blind, only about 15% are online. Because Windows, for a lot of folks, not just Windows, but the whole screen reader stuff, there's a lot of people who haven't been taught effectively, and so all they know is what I call operate by superstition. Press this and the computer will say this. When it says that, do this. Well, with today's software, that's not going to cut it, because you've got to be good at screen exploration with whatever your screen reader calls it. In JAWS, it's the JAWS cursor. In Window Eyes, it's moving the mouse pointer, and they've all got it. And you've really got to be comfortable with that and a lot of other things. And when you first sit down, that's a daunting thing to get over, not to mention just learning Windows.
Yes, it surprises me. I've been doing a lot of work on this, actually, in the last little while, in another capacity, actually designing what may become a new training service here in New Zealand for blind people to learn access technology. And it really does surprise me how many people never use their review cursor, whatever it's called in their particular screen reader, and that they haven't been taught the basics that when you get into a new application, the first thing you should probably do is tap the Alt key and explore the menus, just little fundamental things like that.
I teach a lot of people, and I always do this one internet access class I do every couple of months. It's about a 10-hour little thing. It's kind of fun, and some of the people online have been at it. But there I get like 10 people at a time, and a lot of them have used screen readers, and it just amazes me when we talk about whatever the program is, you know, how many people know where, let's say, the JAWS cursor is. And even now, about half the people don't. And to me, it is critical to understand how to explore the computer screen. I tell people, it's your hand, much like, because one of the questions I ask everybody who I work with, whether it's in a one-on-one or a class, is, you know, what happens when you go to a new house or a new hotel or something like that, and you're all alone and you know nobody's around? And I say that people do what I call they be blind for a couple minutes. And what that means to me is you walk around the room with your hands out, feeling where the walls are, finding where the windows are, everything like that. You just explore. The kind of things that somebody sighted can just take in instantly. You know, I've done it every time I move to a new house or get, you know, I try, when I'm giving a presentation, I try to get into the room alone ahead of time, the day before, to just get the feel. And you got to do that same thing on the computer.
So what happened after the Trace Center?
After about 5 years there, I left for a couple different reasons, and moved out to California, lived in San Francisco for about 6 months, and then down in San Diego for about 6 months. Was kind of working temp jobs, and I had worked for 5 years straight out of college, enjoying life a little bit. Decided I liked having a full-time job instead of temp ones. And saw a job advertised up in Portland, Oregon for an access technology coordinator at a community college, and I liked some of the philosophies that the job offered, one of which was and is that we still offer today, where people can come and take courses on learning screen readers for dirt cheap. You know, you can get 10 hours of my time for $38. Not to mention that I thought I'd be good at it, and I liked the community college setting where it was a focus on, you know, more of a community involvement and things like that. Applied for the job and got it. So I moved up here in 1995, and I'm starting my fifth year.
What kind of courses do you provide in your work?
We have a couple of different things. I have some courses that I've developed that will teach people some mainstream applications as they would use them with a screen reader, because I think a lot of the traditional computer training courses are a challenge for people that are blind because they're so mouse-driven. And so I have some standard courses that people can sign up for. And then we also have a lot of one-on-one stuff where someone might come in and they say, well, I've got this, this, and this. I want to learn how to do these things. That's a very individualized training. You know, I've done things where one gentleman wanted to write his autobiography, and so we spent a lot of time just working on Word. Another person wanted to learn effective scanning of some material, and so I spent a lot of time on that. I like the one-on-one stuff that's kind of the free form, only because it shows me how many different people there are out there who have different disabilities, because I do work with more than just folks that are blind, and the different kinds of things they'll want to do. You know, I've had some people come, actually I had a couple people come, that have taken courses from me before they had already finished their college degree. They were going off to graduate school and they wanted to really bone up on their screen reading skills. And so they took a term with me doing that.
And so will you teach a blind person any screen reader that they want to be taught with?
I don't want to say any, because we offer, I'll be very honest to the people of what I do and don't know. The one that I'm probably the weakest on right now is Window Bridge. But we teach people here, I do, I should say, I don't mean to use the collective, we, Jaws for Windows, Window Eyes, Hail, Outspoken. Those are the four that I did last spring.
Do you have regular contact with the vendors of those screen readers? Do you ever find you have an issue which requires you to get support from them?
Oh, sure.
And how would you assess, without ruffling any feathers, how would you assess the different levels of support available from the different companies now?
Well, now we're getting into it.
Well, you've had 40 minutes to warm up, you know.
I've said it before, and let me say this. No screen reader or mainstream software company is perfect. And you know what part of the issue with support is? If they solve your problem, you think they're great. If they don't, you think they're jokers. So I'll preface it with that, okay? Because I don't want to get a bunch of hate email now.
Oh, that would be dreadful.
In internet support, I think that it's clear that GW Micro, at least from the list I'm on and things like that, is much more out there than Henter Joyce. Now, when I've emailed people at Henter Joyce privately and not on lists, I've gotten the answers I need. The people from Dolphin that do HAL are quite good. You know, they're out there, and they're where they can be found. Outspoken. I'm not sure what's going on with them.
No, I'm not sure either. And it's interesting because I hear rumors that they're planning some kind of big new release that's going to be working with the net better than anything else, according to them. But I don't know when that's scheduled for.
That's what I keep hearing and stuff like that. The people, I actually still teach people how to use it on the Macintosh. There are some blind people that use it on the Macintosh. I know a couple that are doing some music stuff on the Mac that have been using it for a while, and so I've helped them with that. Let me just say this about tech support, too. I don't know. I personally don't always look to the companies. I use the email list. I mean, everybody sees me on them, and, you know, they know who I am by that. I'll use whatever email list will get me an answer. Whether it comes from the company or not, I don't always care. Now, for someone that's new, they should give greater weight to technical support. Like, if you pick up the phone, is someone going to be willing to walk you through what you need than I do?
It must be a difficult line for many screen reader vendors who are pressed, and it's not the most profitable of industries, when you have an issue that actually relates more to someone's inability to use an application than the actual screen reader itself. And often, of course, because of the tight integration between the two, it is difficult to separate the issues. But that, I imagine that they must have a lot of time taken up with issues that don't really relate to their product.
You know, I don't work for any of them, but I've done technical support at the Trace Center, and even then, at least half the calls I answered were related to the computer in general, and not the specific application that we had released. And I would bet that the numbers are pretty close in. If not higher, in the access world. I mean, you can just use, because it's so integrated. Someone says, well, how do you use the spell checker? Okay, well, you know, I can tell you how the spell checker in Word works, But what you really want to know is, how does it work with your screen reader? So is that a screen reader issue, or is that a word issue?
Yeah, and that's precisely why mainstream courses often don't do it for blind people, because the answer to how do you find out what the word in context is in the word spell checker will differ depending on what screen reader you're reading, and there's no way that you could expect a mainstream tutor to know those things.
And if you expect the mainstream, I mean, because that word in context is on the screen, for them to understand that your review cursor only has access to certain things and not this, I mean, that don't get that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You were talking about being online earlier and using mailing lists, and you're, a contributor to many, many email lists. You've obviously got your filters sorted out very well so that you can get through all this mail. But I just wonder if you can tell me about when you first got online.
The first online service I actually used, I was using bulletin boards and stuff like that in 1986 or 87, way back when. The first real, like, national or international online service I used was back in, I think it was 1989 or 90. Got online with something called Genie.
Oh, yes.
I actually worked my way up to the assistant moderator of the whole disabilities forum on that. And I actually liked that a lot because I kind of thought of it as, back in the early 90s, my high-tech way of using my journalism skills and still doing disability stuff. It's all volunteer. I mean, I got a free account, big deal. But I started back then, you know, kind of doing online stuff. And then Genie kind of fell by the wayside. I think GE just kind of lost interest in it. And
yeah, it got a bit horribly slow after a while, didn't it?
Yeah. And I moderated over to the internet, you know. I started using Gopher servers and email and all of that. So I've been online for a long time.
Yes. You say those FidoNet bulletin boards of the late 80s, like, you know, the Opus boards and Maximus, and the original Fido BBS, I think, was really big in about 86, 87. They were good little communities, and there were a heck of a lot of blind people running those things.
There were, and I mean, it was great, and the big blindness Vital Mail conference, what's the name of it? It's escaping me.
BlinkTech.
Blink
Talk, sorry, yeah.
Willie Wilson down in Pittsburgh ran that,
yep.
You know? It was a great support because you just can't find enough people most of the time in any one community that are using all this stuff, you know? I mean, the list that you run, you know, your blind tech is a classic example.
I think the first time that I noticed that this kind of communication was having a real impact on the blind community was when Jamel was removed from the NFB. I think the lists then, the blindness-related echoes, as they were on FidoNet, really played a significant part in the reaction to that decision.
Well, I think what it's given us is our arena, if you will, isn't big enough to be covered by the national news media or the local news media or anything like that. And we're so spread out. But now what we finally got is a pipeline for that information to be exchanged, you know? It dazzles my mind when I think about, you know, we got people from all over the world helping each other, and, you know, the audio stuff that you're doing is certainly very popular, and it's like, this is great. This is what, you know, we're all able to help each other.
The other side of the coin, of course, is that there are problems relating to accessing of certain types of material on the web, etc. And this is something that you're well known for in terms of your advocacy for improved access. What actually is accessibility? I ask this question because I also run the PC audio list, and this has come up a few times where somebody has written in and said, don't use such and such a program because it's not accessible. And other people have used it and found it actually quite usable. So I suppose one person's access challenge is another person's kind of ridiculous comment.
You just answered in a nutshell. The in the physical world, there's, in my office, I've got tons of books that I can go to somebody has a question, how wide should a door be? How high should a table be? What slope should a ramp be for accessibility? And at least it gives them an answer. Whether it really, like, helps most people in wheelchairs or not is, you know, sometimes people in a power chair can't get through a door even when it's built to specs. In the software world with blindness and the internet, you know, it is, I know that some people think I'm outspoken, or I think some people think I have too high of a standard of what I expect in terms of web accessibility, because even, you know, the biggest barrier I find is web pages that don't have alt tags on their pictures. That's when we all get the gobbledygook URLs we have to sort out. I mean, you know, you could argue that, well, because you can still do that, it's accessible. My definition of accessibility involves some measure of efficiency and functionality. And I think, at least in the web, you know, the web accessibility guidelines that have been put out, they divide it into three priorities, priority 1, 2, and 3. And they talk about the priority 1 guidelines being most important, and I think if people look at those, I tend to think that they're important. Is a site impossible to use if they're not followed? No, you know. But a lot of effort's gone into those, and I think that, you know, we should try and support them.
And the boundaries keep changing, don't they? I remember a few years ago that any site that had frames on it was considered by many people inaccessible. And maybe that was because a lot of people were using links or something. These days, a lot of blind people actually encourage sites to have frames because
sure,
it's easy to navigate.
And it sorts out a lot of that clutter. It is a moving target to some. I mean, I remember, Jonathan, I don't know if you remember this. I remember the days when I first started using Netscape when there was no direct keyboard.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And then if there was no alt tag, you were in real trouble then because it would just completely skip the link.
Or when you were trying to find edit boxes in the first beginning, when you were trying to find an edit box to type in,
you could not
navigate to it without using your screen reader's mouse movement commands and clicking the mouse, you know, from the keyboard, where you believe the edit box would be.
Yes. And JFW really cracked that one. They were the first, as I remember, to actually provide keyboard navigation that was actually their scripting rather than Netscape to
right,
get you into an edit box.
You know, so it is a moving target. And so one of my concerns is, rightly so, GW Micro, Kendra Joyce, the WinVision people, SynthaVoice, and everybody else. When I mentioned it's a couple of companies, I'm not meaning to leave anybody out. But they're all promoting what they're starting to do with active accessibility, and rightly so. But the World Wide Web is evolving. We're seeing more and more Java applets being put on web pages. We're seeing more and more full-blown, you know, internet-based Java applications. And so, while I love what we can do now, and it's going to be a constantly moving target.
Do we risk making the whole access issue far too complicated for web developers, and therefore incurring their wrath? I guess, you know, the comment that it's all about alt tags really hits home for me. Many pages that would appear to most screen reader users these days to be perfectly adequate. Absolutely every link has an alt tag, it's reasonably easy to get around, would still not pass the Bobby test.
That is correct. And I don't have an answer, because sometimes I do wonder if the Bobby test and all of that are we demanding 100% perfect HTML writing or not? You know, and if we are, is that bar way too high? Because I am a realist. I know some people might question that with some of my stances online, but I do wonder, I understand that we have to live in the real world, and deal with things as we encounter them. And, you know, if 1,000 people aren't coding things a certain way, it's a lion's task to change them to doing so.
Do you think Bobby might be a bit over the top?
Oh, not anymore, because I think in the past it was because it was so terse in its explanations. I think they have improved it to the point where it tries to educate rather than castigate. When I read the results of a review, I think it really tries to educate people about why this stuff is important and what really matters, and it gives you some examples and things like that. So I think it's been improved.
I mean, the last time I looked at Bobby, which was not that long ago, they seemed to put up a warning flag if you had more than one link on one line. Now, I mean, who really cares about that these days? That might have been an issue when people were using links by the thousands, but that's not really an issue now, is it?
And I think you are correct, and I think I would imagine if I was a webmaster who ran my site through Bobby without knowing much else and I saw all that stuff, I would probably just throw up my hands and say it's just too hard.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I try and encourage people to open up dialogues with their webmasters to explain what this is really saying, and to the people that are developing the web evaluation tools like Bobby. Okay, like I remember in the past, a lot of the web accessibility guidelines and stuff just repeatedly said, no tables, no tables, no tables. Well, that wasn't the real issue, because for a long time, you know, with the MSAA modem window eyes or the default behavior in links or the JFW reformat, the when tables were used to present information in multiple columns, all the screen readers just dealt with it. So now the information on table accessibility has become more instructive, talking about if the information is truly tabular in nature, say a bus schedule or something like that, use some of the advanced HTML tags to inform people about that.
So there's a kind of convergence going on, isn't there? There's an emergence of standards, which of course are welcome, and also screen readers are becoming more adept at dealing with more complex web pages, and of course we do have active accessibility for Java on the horizon.
It is a convergence, and I was actually thinking about this yesterday, thinking about the last 3 years in terms of just how's access gone and what's been happening, and I think that 1999 is going to go down as a fairly positive year. In a lot of arenas. I think that 97 and 98 were kind of not so good. What was it, 97 that we had the IE4?
That's right, yes.
Debacle?
Yep.
98 was just whatever. In 99 here, we've had a lot of nice things. I mean, WindowEyes has had their stuff out for a while. In the OCR arena, whether you're using Kurzweil 1000 or Arkenstone or even off-the-shelf products, the accuracy of that stuff has just gotten way better. I'm starting to see mainstream people in a small way take note of web accessibility, I think in a little bit anyway, and the standards are getting applied in some settings. And hopefully we're moving to, let's really look at what people who are blind and other disabled people need to access the electronic infrastructure, and maybe a little bit past the golly gee whiz, there's that blind guy and he can use a computer because it talks. And the assumption that the computer talks so it works perfectly. That's what the media kind of assumed before. And then we went through a phase where it was all horrible. Well, the World Wide Web is horrible because it's all pictures and blind people are closed out. I think we're getting to a middle ground. I hope we are.
With your background in journalism, the point you made raises some interesting questions about the way that blind people are portrayed in the media. And, of course, with the news desk email list that distributes articles about blindness issues to people interested in reading them from regular newspaper sources. I think you posted something once and made the comment that maybe we'll make some progress when a blind person getting a college degree isn't a novelty.
I think in the mainstream press, when we back off from the technology side, it's blindness is still not understood. And a lot of times it's still a novelty, and blind people doing interesting things is still a novelty. One of the reasons I contribute to your news desk list and a companion list that I run called Disability News, where I also send the stories. I send a news desk plus stories on a whole bunch of other disabilities, and that's on eGroups also, is because it intrigues me, and I just like to see, well, how is the media talking about disability? Are they covering it, reasonably or what? And I don't know, it goes back and forth. Like I say, sometimes I don't think they, in the end, I don't think they do still really get it, that we're basically just folks living our lives. And,
it may be that there need to be more people who infiltrate the media, for want of a better word, that we need more blind journalists, blind presenters, everybody in the media field.
I think it's that, and I think it's just we need more people who are blind in the positions of influence in society. I mean, whether that be blind people in the Congress, blind people as business leaders, blind people as educators, as captains of industry, or whatever, where people can see us as just folks, doing what we do. Some good, some not so good, just people.
Obviously, with your strong views on advocacy, etc., are you involved in either consumer organization of the blind in the U.S.?
No. I think I'm not involved in either group. I know people in both groups. I respect some of what each group does, and people that are online who are hearing this, I'm sure know the things I've said against both groups, and I make no secrets of the things I've respected about them and the things I haven't. I have no ingrained anger or hatred towards either group. I disagree with the philosophies of each group in some ways, and I agree with some. And for me, I get what I need by using their email list and talking to people, I guess. I don't feel particularly akin to join either one at this time.
Do you think that they are doing sufficient in terms of web and software accessibility?
Probably not. I guess. And I don't, again, I'm not, that's not leveled as a criticism, and people could say, well, if you don't think they are, then you ought to join one and get in there. And I guess I've taken the approach that I do contribute to that arena, the accessible web and software, in ways that are independent of either group. I think it, Both have people that are very knowledgeable on the topic, and so but I guess I haven't seen. If I'm wrong, people can feel free to correct me and point me in the right direction. I haven't seen either group take huge leadership positions on some of the accessible web issues or software design. I know that both groups are on like things like the Microsoft Advisory Committee, although I'm not sure what that committee really does. It seems like the biggest mystery around. And I know that I've seen the NFB with their software accessible guidelines and things like that. So I'm not saying they're not involved. I don't know. I don't know who is taking the leadership role in accessible software. One company that I know gets bashed a lot, but for better or worse, Microsoft does an awful lot for software accessibility. They do a lot more than some companies. Most, in fact.
Do you think that there's a danger that with more focus being put on technology in people's lives, that consumer groups, if they don't get to grips with this problem, more will become less and less relevant?
That's hard to say. But I guess I would like to see them, you know, I think that it's, in life it's a balance. I'm not a technocrat or whatever word you want to use, in the sense that I don't think that you should just adopt technology, if you'll pardon the pun, blindly. But I do think it is here, and we need to understand how it's impacting our lives and where that's influencing people who are blind. And I think that the consumer groups and all of us have to understand that and get involved in the areas where those decisions are being made at the design level. It does no good. By the time a consumer product hits the marketplace, the next one is, you know, let's say a cell phone or an ATM or a VCR or who knows what, all the new gadgets they're making. By the time that product hits the marketplace, the next product is probably already in testing behind the scenes, because the life cycle of technology in today's thing is so short.
And that's something that we haven't covered too much really in this interview so far, is that we've talked a lot about software and computer hardware, etc., but there is a whole range of appliances and devices that are computer independent that it is now becoming increasingly difficult for us to use.
You know, we've stuck to the safe area, if you will. And I think that's what's happened with a lot of where our blindness efforts have been focused, because we can actually get at the software and the computer stuff for the most part. I was in a radio studio the other day with a student of mine who, and, you know, I mean, their whole radio studio was run off a touch screen.
Hmm.
If the DJ wanted to, you know, up the volume on something, dragged his finger across. Had a whole little touch screen where he could run through a whole bunch of things, and it was just all, you know, point and drag your finger. Now, again, people debate accessibility here. You know, the net saw the whole thing about cell phones, and you can pick any topic, and it's the same thing. People who are blind are great at memorizing buttons, and, you know, I know if I hit these three things, this will happen. So does that accessible? You know, I don't know.
What's the angle that we must take on these sorts of issues? Because I can see that when you're talking about web accessibility and things like that, there are wider advantages in making sure that the web page is accessible, because there may be people with older technology, perhaps people who just have a little bit of lost vision who are older. So you can see that there's a big market to be had in making sure that the web pages are accessible. Can you apply the same kind of logic to day-to-day household appliances or bits of hardware that are not PC-based?
To some degree, I think you can, and I sure hope we can, because if we just try and appeal to their... if we tell them they have to do it because it's a law, unless we want to go fight court battles every day, it won't happen. If we tell them to do it because, you know, it closes out the whole population of people, well, we're not... The real question that the consumer groups and all of us would have to answer, are we big enough for them to stand up and listen to? Do we represent a big enough market share? I don't know. You know? So what we've got to try and do is find other things that we can hook our trailer up to, if you will, or hitch our wagon to. And one of the things is, at least here in the States, the population is getting older.
Yes.
And, you know, people that are getting older don't want to be labeled as disabled, because that has a huge stigma. But they are diminishing in their abilities. And so what we want to do is try and find things like that. And then look for other reasons, like, you know, especially with, like, the talking technology, like on cell phones. You know, find reasons. You know, it's been... People have been criticized for taking their attention away from their driving, and rightly so, when they're doing different things on their cell phones. system. So we got to find a way to say, well, look, if you add this audio stuff to it, you know, people have this multimodal way to do it. On so, washing machines and stuff like that, you know, where it's all flat sometimes, or microwave.
Well, yes, so it's a mixture of appealing to these companies' bottom lines versus taking any legal measures that are necessary, because the microwave is another good example. There are people who are busy doing other things when something's defrosting. They might be at the other end of the house and they don't hear the little beeps that the thing makes. They might hear it yelling at you that it's time to turn the food over or go to the next step.
You know, it really is a combination. And obviously we haven't hit on the right answer all the time, because if we had, it wouldn't be where we are. And I don't know if there is a right answer. You know, I look at one product, one mainstream vendor that tried to enter and do something in the access arena, and I don't have figures, but I would suspect, given that they never did anything else, that it didn't go too well. And that was the Franklin Electronics Speller. Yeah. Have you ever saw that?
Yes, it did. Yeah. Yes. And yet, you know, on the bright side, you can look at some of the cell phones that are coming out now with voice dial built in, not just on the actual switch, but into the telephone itself. The Parrot is something that we have adopted that was for the general market. So there are some precedents.
And there are. Those are two excellent examples. And so we'll have to see which way it goes.
Well, hopefully we'll have to engineer which way it goes with a bit of luck.
And that really is. And that's why I say that we've got to find ways to get in at the design and decision-making level, you know, and that means talking. I'm probably guilty of it as much as anybody else, and some people would say I'm more so guilty, of making sure that we understand what we want and articulating that in a proactive approach, and not just if there's a negative to some of the email lists and stuff, it's very reactionary and it gets real animated and real emotional very fast.
Just before we go, for people who next surf the web and find a site that they find difficult to access, give us a rundown. How do you think they should approach that issue with the web developer?
Well, one of the things I like to encourage people to do is to talk to other people, first of all, and understand what's happening. You know, and I run an email list called WebWatch where we talk about this, and there's all the other lists where people talk about it, so that you have an understanding to make sure that you know that it's not just something that you're missing, and that's not a negative, but it could just, I mean, I find sites that I say, hey, I can't use this, and somebody says, oh, did you know this? And then when I talk to website developers, I try and look at the HTML if you have that ability to understand what's happening, and make a couple suggestions and say, you know, this would really help. And try and be polite and drop them a note and say, you know, this is why. And I don't always mention that I'm blind, even, because sometimes when you do that, you get a whole different set of stereotypes that you're dealing with, but explain. You know, even today, people don't always load images and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, visit the site a couple times, with a couple days apart, and things like that.
So don't be too quick to jump to conclusions.
Indeed, don't. And, you know, run the site through Bobby, even though it's a, you know, it will give you some pointers on what's really going on with the HTML and things like that. And I really encourage people to talk to other folks about a website, at least, you know, to see what's happening. Because sometimes it is just a quirk of the particular browser and screen reader you're using, and, you know, you should just get a feel for that.
Well, it's been a very interesting hour we've spent with you, and I'm sure those of us who've seen you on the lists feel like we know you a little better, and I really appreciate you giving up your time to be with us.
It's not a giving up, it's a sharing, and I really appreciate all that you do, Jonathan, and I, like I said in my email to you, I feel honored that you've chosen to talk to me on your show.
Oh, it was a good decision. Thank you very much for that.